I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
All right, guys, listen, I know last week I was saying that I'm a conservative right-wing fascist, but I was just joking. And the reason why I want to make this very clear right off the start is that this episode is brought to you by the Nova Scotia Liberal Party.
That's right. Hey, you know what?
That's really funny.
Actually, this episode, Trudeau called me and said, "Listen,
for this week,
I'm gonna pay you, I'm gonna pay you 1 year's worth of CERB. So if you'll just have Zach Churchill on the show." And I said, "All right, consider me reborn." But and all jokes aside,
you're such a shill.
I know. I'll fucking do whatever for the money, man.
I love how this podcast is like weirdly oftentimes about politics. Like we're like talking about politics, and I feel like we know less about politics.
Yeah, I was
going to
say the most illness, unpolitical people imaginable. Very exciting. We had our good friend Zach Churchill come in, who you know. For real, actually, is the opposition leader here in Nova Scotia for the Liberal Party, and we had Zach in a while back, maybe last year, mm-hmm. to talk about the fact that so Zach played a huge role in securing Trikafta for me, which was really cool, and so to have him in and chat about that was like that was just such a nice opportunity and a great moment to connect with someone who helped change my life forever. Actually, I'll say this to you guys. I had clinic a couple of weeks ago, speaking of Trikafta, and my lung function was 87%.
Yeah, that's insane. And how low was it at your lowest?
Like 50.
Yeah, that's crazy. Mm-hmm. When you told me the other morning at the gym that it was 87%, I got goosebumps. It just like it came over my entire body. And okay.
Well, the entire body.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I've never had goosebumps on my dick.
It was weird. And then I had to go get checked.
Again, this
after.
Is an episode that is brought to you by the Liberal Party. Just want to just put that out there. We're talking about goosebumps on Brian's dick.
Anyway, and, I had to get them checked. And thank God for free healthcare here because I was able to
quote unquote free
verify that they were actually just in fact goosebumps. And that was, it was normal. It was normal.
But yeah, wild. My lung function. I feel the best I've ever felt in fucking a decade. So shout out to everybody involved in bringing Trikafta to Canada and especially Nova Scotia. But so we brought Zach back in because just to throw this out there, and this kind of came, this news was kind of bubbling when Zach was coming in, but there was. So here in Nova Scotia, like it's fucking cold. Like right now, last night we had 25 centimeters of snow drop. And the week before that, we had like 50 to 60 centimeters in Halifax. But like Cape Breton got like, 150 or something. It's fucking insane. It was like snowpocalypse here.
Yeah. And for our American listeners, it's a lot of inches.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
like,
so.
Like 36 plus
inches. Yeah,
around. Think about it.
Yeah.
And so so the reason I'm bringing that up is that
great reference.
We had Zach come in to talk about the housing crisis here in Nova Scotia, which is fucked. And
as it is in a lot of places,
yes,
I believe.
Of course. Around that same time we had that conversation, there was an announcement that a lot of the people that there's a number of homeless encampments around town with like that are tents. There was a lot of people that kind of pitched in to include some like weatherproof tents, like sort of Arctic style tents. They're pretty cool looking, actually. You know, which is much more safer than a pop-up tent from Canadian Tire.
Definitely safer, but also still a lot of risks associated with that.
Great. Very shitty
for Canadian winter.
And so when we had this conversation with Zach right around that same time, there was an announcement that they were booting a bunch of these people out of these encampments. And their alternative was, well, we've created a giant shelter in the Halifax Forum, which is like a big multi-purpose center here in the city. You can a lot of concerts and there's like sporting events and stuff. But the caveat is that no one was using this encampment because in order to stay the night there, you have to be sober. And of course, this is a fucking multi-layered issue. And a lot of the people that are in that position of not being home are also in the position of struggling with addiction. And it's not like you can just wake up on a Monday, get kicked out of your tent, and then, you know, night go to the encampment and go, yeah, I kicked my addiction, so I'm here and going to be sober for the night.
I think the other problem with the shelters too is that I think a lot of people felt that there was dangers associated with being in there.
Sure.
So, you know, like you're sleeping in close proximity to other people.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think that most people can imagine that it doesn't feel like a very safe and comfortable place to be.
So yeah, this conversation with Zach.
Well, let's also acknowledge that it's better than being outside in minus 10 degree weather.
I think that some people feel it's better to be in the tents, and which is why they're staying there, because, you know, in particular, like young single women would prefer to be in a space that is, you know, their own.
Or think of a small family, or, you know,
I guess that's
some of the criticisms I saw.
I guess that illustrates how
multi-layered,
how shitty it is, really, no matter what.
Yeah, exactly.
Because if sleeping outside during winter in Canada is a better option to what is what your other option is, then
yeah. And so that's a big part of what we talk about with Zach, is like the complexity of this issue. It's there's no one size fits all answer to this, and or for us to get to a point where we do have some answers and we do have some solutions, it's going to take a lot of fucking work. And so, again, like I said, we are not very political at all. And for anybody listening to this, don't consider this like, you know, some sort of conversation where like we are taking any sort of political side. We're just hearing from somebody who is a policymaker, somebody who has, you know, a voice and a platform to advocate for change, and hearing their side of it.
I think the great thing about Zach though is that he doesn't really speak, you know, especially in this conversation that we had. Like, it's not so much a political thing than it is him just talking about the larger problems that exist and like how we sort of found ourselves in these situations, and, you know, what the potential avenues or options are to get out of that. You know, obviously he is coming from a bias, but at the same time, I think this conversation does a good job at like, you know, throwing those political biases aside and just speaking to the larger problem at play.
Absolutely. So without further ado, let's get into an absolutely lovely conversation with our old friend, Zach.
Guy that's probably 7 inches shorter than you call him. Little tiny Tim.
Everybody calls him Little Tim. Everybody knows.
Everyone knows.
No one says it to his face, but everybody knows.
That's a good impression.
Brian, just make sure you don't lean forward too much. All right. Let us get into it. All right. Well, we are joined again with our good friend Zach. Zach Churchill, the MLA for Yarmouth, leader of the Nova Scotia Liberal Party, former Minister of Health here in Nova Scotia, and you're on the show here today because we become government shills over here at Sick Boy Podcast. So, you know, it's whatever party is going to pay the most to get their message out, and Zach is just shelling out the big bucks today.
One sec, guys. I think I left my Tesla running in the parking lot, so I'm just going to go turn it off.
Zach, thanks for coming in. Looking forward to chatting with you. I know that there's a bunch of stuff that we want to cover. We don't have a ton of time, but love having you in the studio. And I know we're going to be diving into to homelessness, which is, you know, it's not a problem that is local to just here in Nova Scotia. It's a worldwide problem. It's most certainly affecting our country in a big way. And it feels like, I don't know, maybe I'm naive, but I feel like it has become much more of an issue over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years. But maybe I'm wrong on that. What's your stance on that?
I mean, the stats are that those that are living homeless right now has doubled in the last 2 years.
Wow. Okay, so
we're actually seeing a pretty rapid escalation of homelessness in the province. And I think the shocking thing for a lot of people is it's not just a Halifax or HRM thing now. This used to just be a city issue, a city problem. Mm-hmm. I've traveled across the province. It's happening in Sydney, New Glasgow, Yarmouth. We have people living in tents now, and it's a really scary situation for a lot of people. And the further shocking thing is that it's not just the people you think are the usual suspects who mm-hmm. are going to be homeless or finding themselves homeless now. Mm-hmm. Who people are dealing with, like, acute mental health issues, severe addiction challenges. Mm-hmm. You're now hearing stories of working people who are finding themselves living mm-hmm. in tents, and they've got kids. Mm-hmm. And the gentleman, we've had two people die.
Oh my God.
In the last, this winter, mm-hmm. Living on the street. One of them, his name was Dan, had two kids, was working part-time, was trying to heat his tent with propane. And, I think carbon monoxide poisoning.
Yeah.
And like, it's a very, scary situation, for a lot of people.
That's a really, striking statistic that it's doubled in the past 2 years. Is there anything that, like, when you look at the reasons or potential causes for that, are there things that to you seem like obvious red flags?
Well, yeah. I mean, the cost of living, the fact that, you know, here in Nova Scotia, rent has just increased 21% in the last year. We've had some of the highest rent increases in the country. So that's literally the difference of people being able to afford to live somewhere or live in a tent for some mm-hmm. Nova Scotians. We've also seen the income assistance frozen for 2 years in a row. Other government supports available for those that are financially challenged or low income, like the heating assistance rebate program cut, rent supplement program cut back, or the eligibility cut back. So there's been some programming cuts that have, I think, impacted the most financially vulnerable. But we also have to talk about the elephant in the room too, and that's the fact that, you know, we've grown a lot. We've had a major increase in population, mm-hmm. and that has led to a situation where we've probably grown a little too quickly, mm-hmm. and we've run out of houses, mm-hmm. and that's driving price up, and that's affecting availability. And one thing I am concerned about is the current government's agenda to double the population when we're already hitting a wall on growth right now. Growth is good. We want immigration. We want to grow the population. It comes with all kinds of important things. You know, mm-hmm. our whole economic mm-hmm. system is built around growth, but we have to do it in a sustainable way mm-hmm. where we're not overrunning our housing supply or our government services. And I think that's starting to happen right now.
Do we understand, like, why that problem is happening now? Because I remember, like, at the start of COVID, when we would hear that, you know, there's a lot of people moving from places like Toronto back to Halifax or to Nova Scotia, even people from the city moving, like, to the towns outside of the city. Like, from my understanding and impression, when COVID started, like, that was something that was going to be, like, an acute problem for a short amount of time, but like once we settled back into like normal, quote unquote normal life, that would settle down a bit. But it seems like it's only continued to ramp up. Can you make sense of that?
Well, I think we were all surprised by the in-migration from other provinces, Ontario and Alberta, in particular, and to a lesser extent, BC. I mean, our population just shot up. And for the first time, you know, I come from Yarmouth. We've had a very stable population, you know, dealing with a bit of decline. And, you know, I know the town population during the two COVID years went up 500 people, which is an exciting thing. It's a good thing, you know, and people were looking to Nova Scotia because we were safe and looked at as an affordable destination to live, and for the young people that came to you know build and grow a family here. We've all of a sudden become not very affordable, one of the least affordable jurisdictions in the country, and we have not kept up with development and housing. So we've overshot the mark, and I do think we have, you know, a provincial government focus now on continuing that growth without a real plan to accommodate it. And if we are going to grow and people that move here are going to be successful and not destitute and have access to government services that they need, I mean, we do need to have a rate of growth that is sustainable and that we can actually keep up with. And I think we've overshot the mark on it. It's an uncomfortable thing to talk about, but I think it's part of the equation here.
It feels like such an impossible problem though, because like you think like, well, one solution is like build more houses. But like when you look at the houses being built, like none of them are affordable to begin with. So like if people are, you know, not making enough money to live in those houses and then are not buying those houses, like how...
Although if there is more supply, then that is going to affect the overall, the costs of housing overall,
like over
right?
time.
Right? Like, yeah. Like I wonder... When we have this growth, where do you see some of like the focus on housing in terms of like what we need? If you were kind of to like rank order, like affordable housing, single family structures built, whether it's in like developing further suburbs as we sprawl outside of what we've, you know, most of my life considered to be Halifax or like, you know, the city proper versus like high rises on the peninsula or, you know, stuff like that.
Well, there's a spectrum there. And the fact is that right now we need emergency shelter and housing for those that are dealing with homelessness and in precarious situations. We need transition housing for, women in particular who are, you know, either stuck or trying to get out of, violent or scary situations. Then we also need affordable housing for, you know, non-market housing for people that are not going to be able to afford what the current market is. And then we need the market to actually catch up to the growth. And if we get a vacancy rate of about 3%, the experts say, then the competition will start leveling the prices out.
So that's the target is to have a 3% vacancy to normalize price growth in the housing market?
Yeah, the markets that have, you know, a vacancy rate of 3% or higher tend to be more competitive, and the housing market, they stay lower, the prices are more stabilized. But we also have this kind of emergency housing situation, transitionary housing situation, where the normal the private market's not going to build this stuff. This is where government actually needs to come in, build facilities, give money to the great not-for-profit community organizations that we have around the province who want to build affordable housing and have, you know, wraparound services at some of the emergency housing, right? So that people can have, I think, access to safe supply. So they're not getting desperate. And this is what we really need to have a plan to do here.
In terms of emergency housing and affordable housing, what is the gap between what we have versus what we need?
Well, we've got, I think, you know, it's in the around 2,000 people that are homeless right now. Not everybody's living rough on the street. There's hundreds that are across the province and here in Halifax. Many are couch surfing or finding places. But, I mean, that's the number you have to look at to start. But, I mean, my concern is if the province keeps trying to double the population at the rate they want to, this situation is going to get worse and worse and worse, and we're not going to be able to keep up with it, because housing starts have actually gone down the last couple of years while our population's grown. So we're building, you know, less than we have been previously at a time when we need to be building more. And there's other factors outside of government's control impacting that, interest sure. rates, labor supply, these sorts of things. So we got to be thinking, okay, what else do we have? Prefabricated houses are probably the most affordable option we have. Modular housing, where you can order even prefabricated things in from other areas, ship them in and build these places like Lego in a couple weeks. And get people in. I mean, this is the stuff we have to be looking, the options we have to be looking at right now.
When I think about, I've had this thought a number of times over the last like couple of years, especially as the podcast sort of evolved and we started having more conversations like this, you know, not just speaking to people with lived experience, but also speaking to like policy makers and, you know, people who are working behind the scenes to make Canada a more healthy place. And I've always thought about how, like, I've always viewed homelessness as a you know, a form of sickness, a form of like social sickness. So it's like, you know, we humans get cancer. Cities, their cancer is something like homelessness, right? And homelessness is one of the social determinants of health. So I'm just kind of curious here, as the former minister of health, you know, if you can sort of rewind back to that period in time in your career, how did homelessness and health issues, you know, pertaining to that, how did that all play a role in your work as the Minister of Health when you held that space?
So that's a really good point, is that these issues and Nova Scotia is now leading the country in poverty, in food insecurity, and in high cost of living.
Mm-hmm.
So here's what we know about all these factors, these social determinants of health, as mm-hmm. you mentioned. If you don't have a place to live, or you're stressed out about your housing payments and wonder if you're going to have a place to live, if you don't have access to good quality food, if you can't feed your kids, if you're stressed out financially all the time, you do get sick.
Mm-hmm. And in all facets, I mean, mental health is affected
it's
by
showing
that.
Up in
your
our
physical health is affected
it's
by
showing
that.
Up in our hospitals. Yeah. So, you know, yeah. I've talked to a number of ER doctors across the province. They're getting a lot of people showing up with severe illnesses or major problems.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all linked back to these factors in their lives. So, I mean, we know that if you don't have access to food, shelter, and you're financially stressed out, you have a much higher chance of getting sick and being ill, and it's showing up with major pressures in our healthcare system mm-hmm, right now. Mm-hmm. That our healthcare system is already having a hard time.
So when you were Minister of Health, was this something that you had to deal with on a daily basis? Were the folk, you know, was your focus at that time something a bit different? And I guess my question really is, like, as that role, you know, the person whoever's sitting in the chair labeled Minister of Health, what is their role in all of this?
In developing, you know, healthcare policy and working with a health authority to run our healthcare system. Here's the challenge, though, is that when you're in that role and when you're in government, you're putting out fires every single day.
Sure.
You're putting Band-Aids on the system all over the place. So you're trying to deal with the emergency room pressures and how to handle that. You're trying to deal with all the people without a family doctor. You're trying to deal with all the wait times, and the focus becomes very operational. And I think that is one of the big problems we have with kind of health policy overall, is that it's not focused on health. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things we need to do in Nova Scotia is actually develop investments and programming that can help us be healthier people. And that is from a health and wellness standpoint. How do we help people be healthier, have access to good quality local food, know about exercising, and have access to recreational facilities? There's that side of it, and figure out how to do that and make that stuff accessible, particularly for those that you know, are already financially stressed out and might not have time or the ability to do these things. But also, how do we catch diseases earlier?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got high rates of certain cancers here. If we catch them earlier, we are going to do a better job, not just saving resources in the healthcare system, but saving lives. Because mm-hmm. again, I think I mentioned this last month here, 90% of the resources spent in our healthcare system, human and financial, I believe, are in the last 3 months of somebody's life. Mm-hmm. So we've got to start putting money into the upstream issues affecting people's health and housing, food security, and financial stress are a part of that. And then I think also kind of early diagnosis and doing a better job with chronic care management. Mm. You know, we've got to kind of change the paradigm on how we're dealing with healthcare, or I think we're going to be chasing our tail on it for a long time. And I mean, Nova Scotia now has gone from, again, being one of the most affordable places to live to one of the least affordable. And we also still have some of the highest taxes. Mm-hmm. So everyone's just gotten their property tax assessments who own properties. Brian, sorry that you don't own one yet, but
this might not be good in this situation.
You might not be happy anyway, but I mean, you know, people all over the province are talking about how their property assessments have gone up like double. So people are paying more in property taxes. We have some of the highest income taxes in the country, high sales tax on every single good that people spend money on. There's you're paying tax on tax on tax when it comes to fueling up your vehicles. And I mean, that's one area where government actually has direct control over what they do, and that's how they tax people. So on top of all the increased costs of living, we also have the highest taxes in the country from a number of fronts. And I think that's something that we have to start looking at, because we've got to relieve some of this financial pressure off of people. And again, it's not just a low income issue anymore. This is working families. These are seniors on fixed income dealing with this. And we talked about before we turned the mics on, this young generation coming up that is like, oh my God, am I even going to be able to afford a life here in Nova Scotia? Am I ever going to be able to afford a home? Mm-hmm. Can I build a family here? Can I afford this? And these are real serious questions that we have to start and issues that we start wrapping our heads around, or we're going to have a generation of people that have grown up here that are going to want to leave and go somewhere else, which happened previously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it is a cultural comedic meme. The idea of there is a lane of memes on social media around the idea of how funny it is for somebody of an older generation to wonder why you don't own a home yet, you know, that. And it's like, hey, well, because
have you seen a graph that shows the difference in average income and the cost of living and the difference in that change over the past 20 or 30 years? It's like that graph pretty much explains it.
I'm interested to know. I was thinking about this morning, knowing that we were going to be speaking with you today. Economically, I very much kind of like lean towards the power of the free market to like regulate itself and for things to, cost what they should cost. We've like entered into an era, it seems, in the last year, and interest rates obviously playing a huge role in that, but where that is not really happening. But where I see that most is tend to see that most is in food prices. Although I think of less regulation around commercial ventures and the economy, I'm wondering how you feel about food and like the prices of food and how they go up, and you know, companies like Loblaws and Sobeys, and how the prices of food are in a lot of cases like far outpacing the rate of inflation's the high rate of inflation that we saw over the last couple of years. You know, I know that there's a lot of dust being kicked up around like corporate profits for, you know, these huge grocery chains, while, you know, you get people who are living on the line, and now all of a sudden the cost of food that they have to buy every week or every month goes up, and now they live below the line, and that's forcing people down into, you know, precarious home situations and things like that.
Or doing their grocery shopping at Dollarama and eating canned food.
Right, yeah. Health issues.
Which, you know, we've all done, but you can't sustain yourself on food that's in boxes and in cans.
Speak for yourself. SpaghettiOs go a long way.
Oh, listen, I did it for a while too. But I mean, that is a big issue now. Mm-hmm. And I do think we do have a free market, system, and I do believe in it, but you do have to have regulation to protect consumers, because, obviously greed is always going to be part of the market, and greed can be a powerful economic incentive to innovate and do well and reduce prices for people. But I mean, there's times when you have to regulate things to protect people. And you know, I think we're seeing that right now on a number of fronts, right? There's been rent control implemented, unsuccessfully in my opinion, because it's rents are still going up higher here than anywhere else. And I think there's other areas where you probably have to look at regulation and work with like people that do the consumer protection work and the advocates to figure out what the best way to do that is. But I think we also have to look at what we're taxing on goods too.
Yeah.
You know, and what we're taxing on people's income and how much money we're investing in, you know, income assistance right now. And again, there was just another announcement this week. No, there wasn't an announcement, actually. We learned from people who were complaining about this online. Another support that's funded primarily through the provincial government, administered through the Salvation Army, the Heating Energy Assistant Top-Up Program, HEAT, you can't apply every year now. So like all of these little... They're not little measures actually for individuals, but these targeted programs, strictly for low income people, over the last couple of years have been scaled back, and that's definitely contributing to some of the food insecurity we're seeing, and I think the homelessness situation. So, I mean, my focus has to be on like, okay, I'm a provincial government guy. What can the provincial government do? Now's really not the time to scale back on these supports targeted for low income people or to freeze income assistance when inflation's gone up. The most it's gone up since the 80s. Now's the time to actually probably enhance, not probably, enhance those supports so people can get through this this difficult period.
Speaking of free market and consumer protection, Brad, you want to ask what you were talking about asking before Zach got here?
I forget what I was talking about.
Brad's a big free market guy, and he was wondering about like consumer protection for stealing from Sobeys. Yeah. Go ahead.
So
go ahead, Brian.
If you are in Sobeys and you go and you look at like the price of Greek yogurt and you see that like last week it was $6 and this week it's $10 and you're like, fuck this and fuck the person that owns this place. I'm just taking this. Should there be protection for me if I or somebody else if they shoplift?
All right. And Zach, go ahead.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Thanks for the question. I mean, the reality is, though, as people get more desperate.
Yeah.
They're going to take more desperate actions, particularly around looking after their basic necessities, which is food and shelter. So we're actually starting to hear from, you know, business organizations, from police organizations, that crime is rising again. Crime rates are rising. Yeah. So, I mean, we are seeing this happen where someone's like, you know what, I'm either going to do something like this or I'm not going to be able to eat. And I think that's why we really have to... spend a lot of time focused on these issues right now and providing what support we can through government agencies and not-for-profit groups and enhancing those right now so that people don't find themselves in that desperate situation where they feel they have to steal to survive.
Well, I mean, like on a serious note, I saw this somewhere the other day and you know, forgive me because I'm just a headline whore and I don't usually read into things unless it has to do with NHI. I did see an article about how here in Nova Scotia, there's, you know, a number of stores are now putting baby formula and baby food behind lock and key, simply because it's just being swiped off the shelves because it's too expensive.
Well, there was a shortage, I think, for a while on that.
And it's not being swiped off the shelves by people who are taking it to resell it. It's probably being taken from
it was apparently, you know,
like a mix of both. How do you square, how does any government, square the need for programs for like social assistance programs in a myriad of different ways across the spectrum of what people need help with? And then also facing an issue where taxes are such an issue and needing and feeling like taxes are an overburden on people. Like how do that those seem like two hard levers to balance.
Well, I don't think they are right now. You know, we our taxes grew during a period of population decline to sustain the services that we have. So when we were losing revenues, taxes were increased to make up the difference and to continue to provide government services. We're now at a point where we've been through 10 years of growth. The provincial government has more money than any government in that I can remember in my lifetime. Provincial government has spent $2 billion outside of their own budgets because they've had additional revenue from income taxes and provincial taxes and also transfers from the federal government. So we're actually in a position now where I think we can put money back into people's pockets and the economy and continue to invest in the areas that we have to. But we have to be smart where we invest, right? We can't just throw money at the wall and see what sticks. Like the government has to have some respect for taxpayers and the resources that are given to them. And I do feel there's been a lot of money kind of thrown at the wall in the hundreds of millions of dollars that aren't producing the right outcomes for people here, that haven't dealt with the housing crisis, that haven't turned the outcomes in healthcare around. In fact, those things are getting worse. So it is about how you spend the money. And I do think you can be smart with how you spend. You can be fiscally responsible and invest in really important social programming. We did it with, like, when I was there, we did it with pre-primary. So we went through a period of greater fiscal restraint, actually lowered income taxes in Nova Scotia, and still found the money to invest in, you know, probably the biggest social program that we've had in a long time here in pre-primary. So every four-year-old now has access to early learning. So it can be done. You just have to be smart with how you're spending money and also be a good steward of the economy so that we can keep growing and gaining the revenues that we need.
One that I see affecting me directly and you know, affecting a lot of people in a really positive way and allowing people to have better access to daycare so that they can then go out in the day and make a living is the benefit for subsidizing daycare. I mean,
oh yeah,
like, yeah. Well, I don't know what I pay, $27 a day or something like that. I mean, when I look at, you know, my friends in Toronto who are going, well, we have two kids, so it's not worth it for one of us to work. Because if I put them in daycare, then my whole salary is paying for my two kids in daycare.
It's so important. And we're not keeping up with the amount of spaces we have to build either. But when we were in government, we worked with the federal government, began the negotiation for that child care deal. And now that's being implemented. The issue now though is, expanding, childcare spaces because we've also hit a wall there and, you know, increased, in migration, either domestically from other provinces or abroad is putting more pressure on it. We're trying to recruit doctors. You know, we're hearing from doctors now, like, well, I can't practice because we need childcare, or, like, you know, if there's two doctors in a family, that's happening. So that is another key part of it. And somewhere where we need to be investing dollars. One of the issues with it, I think, is that 60% of our childcare spaces that have been built in Nova Scotia outside of pre-primary are private operators, you know, for-profit businesses, usually women-led businesses. I think an issue with the current deal is they've all been forced to become not-for-profit. And we've spent the last 2 years trying to convince people that have owned these businesses for their lives or that they have to now become not-for-profit or sell to the YMCA or the Boys and Girls Club. So I think we've lost a chance to build more spaces because we spent the last 2 years trying to change the business model overall. And I think that's I don't know that that was necessary. Because if someone's there's a supply and demand issue right now with childcare, and if someone wants to start a business to do it, I think that's a good thing. Talk about a free market, right?
Yeah.
Because that is impacting the labor shortage. It impacts doctor recruitment. It impacts just another example. I spoke with someone you know, who moved here during COVID, six-figure position. And he says, I got to move back to Alberta. I was like, why? Like, well, my wife can't work, so she has to stay home. That's half of our income gone. Cause we can't find childcare. And I didn't realize how much you're going to tax me here. You know? So we're actually starting to see the numbers retract from other provinces in Canada. people coming here and moving away. But I mean, the thing is, I think there's not silver bullet solutions to any of this stuff, but steps we can take to not lose the growth momentum that we've had and to make life more affordable here and make it easier to age here with dignity and build and grow a family.
I always find that so fascinating how you can look at something like childcare and and you know the programs or the way that we've kind of like organized a particular thing and just how that you know spider webs out into you know like 100 other different things that your mind does not go towards when you think about it, and you take that one issue and you go, that's affecting this and this and this and this, and then that's affecting that. It's wild. I mean, it's a very challenging position for anybody in politics to try and navigate. I mean, I can't imagine thinking about that.
It's I mean, you have to think about it and figure out where you can invest the resources and financial and, you know, policy and programming initiatives to have the biggest impact. Mm-hmm. And again, I think if we can make this province a more affordable place to be and not lead the country in poverty and food insecurity and the highest taxes and all these things, if we can grow our population at a rate that we can sustain, where we're building enough houses and doing that smartly, and where we're spending a lot more energy on not just the healthcare system, but also health outcomes and how to improve those, I think we can get somewhere here.
And speaking of like solutions, you know, as the leader of the Nova Scotia Liberal Party, what are some policy changes or initiatives that you're gunning for, advocating for, to tackle specifically, like to tackle the issue with homelessness?
Well, we've got to have emergency housing for people so they're not out on the streets. People need to be in shelters. So we started raising the alarm along with all the incredible community organizations and advocacy groups that care about this back in the summer. Now the summer was the time to start taking action to get a plan to get shelters in place and find community halls, and you know, why aren't we buying RVs? You know, like there's a bunch of RVs on the market right now. Why can't government do that instead of having to, you know, import pallet buildings? I don't know. Anyway, there's a number of options there, but emergency shelter is key. Mm. I think we have to start having that in place long term here, and having facilities that have emergency shelter and then wraparound services for those that are dealing with acute mental health issues, addiction, and that sort of situation. We need to invest in affordable housing. I think the best way to, and transitionary housing and affordable housing, I think the best way to do that is through the not-for-profit sector.
Mm-hmm.
And getting co-ops going again here.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's a real option that could be viable here. We've had success in the past, and I think we can have success again with that model.
Mm-hmm.
And follow the lead of provinces that are actually doing a good job on the regulation front, making it easier and more cheap to build market housing. And BC is probably the leader in the country right now. They've gotten rid of a lot of the unnecessary rules around development, like parking minimums, setbacks, these sorts of things, all boring stuff to talk about, but really important when it comes to building market housing, and not letting NIMBYism get in the way of a project.
Yeah,
when you need one.
That was my next question, like the, you know, the whole NIMBY thing. I guess so kind of a two-part question. The first part would be, just out of curiosity, like how much of that plays a role in the inability to get the, you know, the space, or the, you know, the space to like put up these emergency housing sort of units, if we had them, like how much does NIMBYism?
You've got to find the right places for emergency housing, but on the market housing side, I do think it has an impact.
Yeah.
Cause everybody wants to preserve, you know, the neighborhood as they moved into it. Not everybody, but sure. I mean, that, you run into resistance there, but we're at the point now where, you know what, we do have to build duplexes. We have to build fourplexes in, you know, predominantly single family neighborhoods. Like it has to be part of our planning now. We have to build densely. And we have to build quickly. So, I mean, BC, again, I think has the leading model in the country on reform around development and housing, yeah. reducing costs and reducing process.
And in terms of the emergency housing, what are the things that need to be considered in terms of like the location for emergency housing? I'm assuming maybe I'm totally off here, but I'm assuming that there's something to the degree of like, you know, within a certain distance of, you know, whether that be hospital or, you know, certain institutions.
Public transit is key.
Yeah.
And having access to, you know, needed services
sure.
But I think public transit is definitely an important factor there.
Sure.
And in areas that isn't going to create safety issues for, you know, for neighbors and businesses.
Yeah. So my the second part of that two part question is what role should the community play in supporting the types of initiatives that, you know, could be helping with the situation?
I'll tell you, the community has stepped up quite a bit, and business leaders have stepped up. You know, if you go down to Grand Parade, I think it was community members that got the winterized tents there.
Okay,
most of the tents weren't
the red igloo tents.
Yeah. So I mean, you've got community organizations all over the province. I've met with a number this week and last week. South Shore, in the Hanses, here in HRM, that are stepping up and doing their very best to help either seniors that are in tough situations or young people that have found themselves homeless. So it's also about ensuring that those organizations have access to stable funding too. These are organizations that have to apply for grants every year or apply for multiple grants just to stay afloat, right? And these are the organizations that are on the front lines right now, whether it's, you know, the women's centers, family resource centers, Shift House in Yarmouth. Like, these are all organizations that are on the front lines doing their thing and helping people right now. And they have to spend a lot of time like applying through government applications, which are, you know, can be obnoxiously complicated. And trying to do that multiple times to get funding to kind of stay afloat. So I think we have to be willing to provide some consistent operational funding to those groups as well.
Hi, I'm Jessie Cruikshank.
Jessie Cruikshank.
I host the number one comedy podcast called Phone a Friend.
Girl, let's phone a friend.
Not only do I break down the biggest stories in pop culture with guests like Dan Levy and members of NSYNC, I do it with my own personal boy band singing jingles throughout. Because it's my show.
It's your show, girl.
New episodes of Phone a Friend.
Yeah.
Drop Thursdays wherever you get your podcasts.
So work it, girl. Yeah, work it.
Okay, that's enough.
This is a little bit on a track that you mentioned in the first part of Jeremy's question there, his last question, around like building densely. When I see, like, I've noticed in particular, the example that's sticking in my head is I've driven down Roby from Kennard and Roby all the way down to go to Point Pleasant Park. And as I'm going down there, I'm noticing like all these empty lots that a ton of empty lots that are all fenced up and looks like there's going to be some development happening there. And I notice that sometimes something will be built and I'll look at the structure and I'll think to myself like, that they a three or four story building was built in a location where, you know, a much bigger building could have been built or something like that to accommodate, you know, just a lot. And I know that there's a whole bunch of factors there and the developer and money and all that stuff, but are there any, like, are there regulations in place that are saying like, if this opportunity to build in a certain location comes to be, that like if a developer is planning on building there, they have to build, there has to be a minimum amount of units that they're putting in or anything like that? Like, is there?
Well, I mean, I certainly think there's regulations in place that are prohibiting the amount of building that can happen at the rate that we need to. there's limits on on height. There's setbacks from the street. There's minimum parking requirements. And again, we've got 50 something municipal units across the province, and they probably all have they do all have some different rules on this. And we have to work with them, I think, to have a more consistent regulatory landscape that's going to maximize the ability to build as quickly as we need to. Because again, we're actually building less, and our population's been shooting up. So this problem's going to get worse and worse.
Are there just like a bunch of antiquated rules, like in different?
There's some, and I mean, the city's made some. Halifax has made some good adjustments. Other municipal units have, but we've got to have some consistency with it. And again, I think the BC model right now has set a good standard in the country to follow, where we can reduce obstacles to building and get rid of unnecessary bylaws, regulations that are stopping us from building as much as we need to. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say the public doesn't need to be consulted. They should be, and they need to be, but that should all happen on the front end when you're, you know, planning out the neighborhoods and not, you know, when you're in the middle of a development and then people try to hold it up.
Mm-hmm. One question I have about politics in general is that I found that
how,
like,
much is it like House of Cards? I how many people have you pushed into a moving subway?
Yeah, that's a good question.
I'm curious about, like, one thing that frustrates me is looking at, particularly to the States, but I think it's true in politics in most places, seeing the polarization of ideas. Ooh. And like the, like, one, something that I was taught at a very young age, I think as we all were, is like the best way to work together, the best way to get what you want is to work together and collaborate with people. It doesn't mean that the other person that you're working with is always right, or that you always have to be right, or things like this. Like, you need to be able to work together. And I find that when I think of the challenges that we need to overcome, it gets down to this point of like political will and making something happen. And, you know, when you look to the States and you see the Republicans versus the Democrats, like, nobody can ever acknowledge a good idea from the other side. And because of that, like, that idea that, like, everything always has to be wrong if it comes from the other person, it feels like it stifles the ability to, like, actually get things done. So I'm curious, from your perspective, in working in politics and trying to, like, solve some of these big problems and probably experiencing a lot of that, like, pushback, is my perception of, like, what happens that sort of like resistance that you get from the opposing side just because they are the opposing side, does that make it more difficult to get things done? And do you find that happens here?
Well, I think there's been incredible moments that I've experienced over my close to 14-year career in provincial politics here of parties totally agreeing on things and voting in favor of pieces of legislation that really matter. The Trikafta coverage would be an example close to your heart, Jeremy. The organ tissue donation bill. Recently, there was a great moment with the current PC government where they're joining up the class action against some of the opiate companies. There are these moments where everyone's like, yeah, this is a good idea. Let's do it. We were able to pass a bill to extend or provide grief leave, bereavement leave. Thank you. There we go. For parents who've lost a child in pregnancy. So there are these really lovely moments where this does happen. And here in Nova Scotia, all the parties do kind of crowd around the center. So there's not like an ideological polarization like there is in the States right now, or that's starting to happen federally. But that's not to say we should always agree. Like, I do think a fundamental component of our democratic system is disagreement and debate and argument and making democracy a competition of ideas, right? I do think there's a lot of value in that. So I don't love being opposition leader. I'd rather be in government making decisions and investing in things that I think can help people. But I do see the value of holding the government to account, pointing out where I think they're missing the mark or where they're spending money that where they shouldn't be spending it. That is a necessary function to keep governments honest. You got a lot of power when you're in government. You're signing big checks, you're writing laws, and you do have to have a counterbalance to that the media and an opposition parties provide. So yeah, I do think, of course, when there's a good decision that everybody agrees with, you know, don't disagree for the sake of it. I certainly try not to do that. Mm-hmm. I also don't feel I have much credibility if I start saying good decisions or bad ideas.
Yeah.
But I do fundamentally believe that not agreeing and providing an alternative perspective mm-hmm. is absolutely key to this democracy, functioning as it should. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, what's the point of voting and having different parties if everybody's mm-hmm. in agreement all the time? You may as well just give the power back to the king.
Totally. I wanted to follow that up with a question about housing in general, because to come like back to the start of this conversation, when you're talking about some of these solutions for housing and like the importance of emergency shelters, and the fact that, you know, you guys were making noise about this in the summer that something had to be done. It like, why can't housing be one of those things that you mentioned that like everybody agrees needs to happen, and it needs to happen now?
I think everyone does agree on that, like all three parties. How we get there is some disagreement on currently, mm-hmm. and there are some ideological differences between the three parties. You know, the current provincial government has decided, well, what we're going to do is create the ability to override Halifax council and staff decisions. We think we're better off, and that means, you know, if a developer doesn't like what they're getting at the city, they can go to the minister, and the minister can potentially override the processes. We like, on our side of the house, more of a rules-based approach. So, okay, if there's rules in place that you don't like, let's change them so everybody knows, and there's not preferential treatment, and everybody knows the rules of the game. And there's jurisdictions, like I said, BC and New Zealand, that have actually done this and are having some success with increasing their housing starts. You know, so there are disagreements of how we get there, but I do think overall there is obviously a consensus that we need to do something here. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's very clear when you walk around anywhere in the city or even in some of the smaller towns and communities in Nova Scotia, and you see people struggling to live every day, and mm-hmm. they're living in tents, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think you can agree on the broad things and still have some disagreement on how mm-hmm. on how we get there. I really do think, you know, another difference is the current government wants to double the population. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
I don't think we can do that right now.
Yeah.
The infrastructure.
Yeah.
You know, Bridgewater's run out of sewage and wastewater capacity.
Yum.
Like, they're set to explode.
Yeah.
With growth. There's not the infrastructure to do it. Our healthcare system is literally getting overrun right now. We got twice as many people that are a family doctor that we did 2 years ago. Wait times are going up to see specialists, to get MRIs. All these other things, and again, the people pressure is the driving factor to this stuff. So we have to grow. We want to keep being a destination for people, but it has to be smart, and I think at a sustainable rate. And there needs to be a plan to invest in the government services, the infrastructure, and the housing to make sure we can do it. So people aren't moving here, and then saying, "I can't. What did I get myself into?"
Yeah.
I can't find a place to live. I'm working a low wage job. Rent's gone up 21%. I thought I was going to be able to bring my family here, but we don't have a place big enough to live. Anyway, you don't want to harm the people that you're trying to recruit here either, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So I mean, that's another disagreement. I think we need to slow it down and be realistic.
Yeah.
And invest in a plan and the infrastructure and government services that we need to keep up with this stuff.
I guess we should also say, just for folks who may not be aware, the current government here in Nova Scotia is the Progressive Conservative Party of Canada. So, you know, just putting that out there in case anyone was like, well, I thought,
who are they?
Yeah, and I don't want to be too partisan in these talking to you guys, but that's why I haven't been using party names or anything.
Sure,
like
sure.
That,
oh, whoops. Yeah. So here we'll bleep that out.
You guys can say what you want. I'm just trying to be work with you.
You heard it here, folks.
You're doing a great job.
Zach, well, I want to say, dude, I really, you know, we really appreciate your willingness to come in here and to talk to us about the current current political climate and situation in Nova Scotia. It's a province that means the world to the three of us. There's a reason why we haven't left here. Because this is our home, and you know, I can't ever imagine living anywhere but here. And so to know that there's people like yourself doing everything in your power to try to make this place the best place that it can be in Canada,
or as you like to say, make Nova Scotia great again.
That's right. Actually, people can't see this, but it's written across Zach's shirt there, red shirt, red hat.
Liberal party.
That's it. Right. But yeah, Zach, honestly, like, I really appreciate your willingness to come in, and also your willingness to, like, you know, to roll with the punches and to have a laugh, but also to get down to like the seriousness of the issue at hand. It means the world to us, and so on behalf of the guys and all of our listeners, thank you so much for doing this.
You guys are lovely to talk to, and I've also got to meet a network of young entrepreneurial creative people in our province just by knowing you guys and being invited to some of the networking opportunities, and that gives me great hope in the future here. Mm-hmm. We've got this incredible burgeoning class of young, exciting creators, entrepreneurs who are thinking differently, who are bringing new business ideas, new art to our province, and you know, my job in the public policy world is to make sure that we're setting the stage and the conditions so that that next generation coming up can stay here and be successful and keep driving this province forward in a positive way. So I'm really inspired by what I'm seeing out there, and I think we need government to start thinking about how are we going to, you know, not just govern for the next election, but the next generation. Mm-hmm. And I do think affordability and housing and having government services that are going to be there for people is going to be key to keeping this generation here and investing in our province.
Totally.
Well, thanks, dude. This has been really great.
Thank you. This is always fun to do. Hope I get to come back.
Absolutely.
That was our conversation with Zach.
What a lovely guy.
He is, really, like, truly just a very sweet man, and like a good hang, you know, like even when the mics are off, it's just like hanging out with an old bud.
Yeah.
Doesn't it make you realize or think about, like, you know how you have the idea that, like, politics in general, just like everything moves very slowly and like promises are made and it's very hard for them to be kept. And then, like, when you have a conversation with a politician and you realize, like, how many things they're trying to think about,
it's a lot,
and accomplish. It's like,
feels like similar to us here at Snack Studios with all of the fucking shows that we're producing.
That conversation almost made me embody the feeling of wow, there's a crushing weight of stuff that needs to be done.
One thing though is, like, when we have a conversation like that with Zach, I feel hopeful for, like, for listening to the ideas from younger politicians.
Yeah.
You know, like, looking to what's happening in the United States, and you have like two ultra old people who are, like, potentially going to, well, one of them is definitely going to be the president of the country. Again, or not again?
I saw, guess, both again. But why does
Trudeau act like he has got dementia? You know what I mean? Like, a little bit, little sus. I don't know.
You know, again, I'm joking.
Fine.
I didn't get to say this in the conversation with Zach. I was thinking it, and then we were moving to wrap up. But I said it in something I posted about short, like right after we had the conversation with him, and it was that like everybody has a political lean in some way or another. Even if you're not political, I'm sure if you were like put to questioning, you'd figure out that you were of a certain lean, and I don't begrudge that of anybody. Everybody deserves that, and everybody should have a political lean, whatever. But no matter what your political lean, what I was really happy about, what I'm really happy about with Zach is that whether you would ever vote for a liberal or not, Zach feels to me like a person that's just like, I'm in it because I care about what I'm doing.
Totally. Yeah.
And all I want is for that to be the feeling that people get from the political leader of whatever lean you go towards.
I've got a couple of things that I really want to touch on in this, and so we can just get silly for a minute, because that was a bit of a heavy
intense
conversation.
Yeah, serious.
So I got some silly shit prepped, but before that, I do have a question. How many politicians do you think actually lean the complete opposite way from their job, but they just landed in that job? So like, they are conservative on paper, but like, they actually vote Green Party.
I would say that most politicians are probably part of the political party that they broadly lean towards. Yeah. But in that same line of thinking, I would say that there are probably several issues on their platform that they're like, I have to promote this piece of the platform because it's part of the platform of the
party
that I represent. But it's not really
how
I would do it.
I think that's the biggest problem with politics is that like, you have to be all one side or the other side. Like, you have to subscribe to, to appeal to like your swath of voters. Like, you kind of have to buy into all of the conservative platform or the liberal platform.
But at least in Canada, we have several parties, and obviously there's two dominant ones, but they do, the platforms are on a spectrum. And having seats in parliament that represent at least, you know, that should theoretically represent kind of like the spectrum.
Oh my God, I'm so fucking
politics.
Bored. Okay. I'm so fucking bored.
Now. I have to ask you guys a question that just gets right out of this because I've been dying to know.
Well, actually, the reason I asked that question is because I went to school with a guy who is in the Conservative Party and he's liberal.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
But that
actually is true. What I should have done was said I went to school with a guy who is in the Liberal Party, but I know he's conservative, and then I should have said his name rhymes with Schmack Burpspiel.
Well, you know what they say. If you're not a liberal in your 20s,
you will be in your 20s. In your 25s,
then you're heartless. And if you're not conservative in your 40s, then you're stupid.
I'm 36.
So okay, so guys, I'm really curious about this. Have you noticed, this is like a personal question about the office here.
Okay.
So we have a shared bathroom situation here. There's a lot of like things that happen in that bathroom.
I've noticed a lot of things.
There's a lot of really funny things.
Yeah. I'm curious if you've had the experience lately where you've been going into the bathroom, one in particular, where the window blinds have been totally up.
Yes. All the time.
Oh, I've
yeah.
noticed that. Yeah. I always go to the bright.
That's me.
Whenever I have to
be looking outside.
So like the window faces into like an apartment / parking lot situation where it's like very easy to see in the window. I mean, the parking lot is like 10 feet away. But it seems like every time I go into the bathroom now, the blinds are all the way up. And like, if you sit down to take a shit or you're standing up to pee, which I don't really stand up to pee. So maybe you guys can speak to this better, but do you find it weird that the blinds are always up? Because I wonder what somebody's doing going into the bathroom where they're like, I want to be on display. Like, is it an exhibitionist sort of thing? Is that you, Taylor?
I notice that the one on the left always has the blinds down and the one on the right always has the blinds up.
I do.
And
I
always go into the one with the blinds up. And my thinking behind this, because I have thought about it and I have noticed it, my thinking is, if you're going to look in to see me using the bathroom in here, the angle that you're going to have to, it's going to
just look like Taylor is like is playing out the final scene of Blair Witch. It's just a guy standing looking at a wall.
It's not, the reason is that it's not, you're not going to see me by accident.
That's what I mean.
Like, the angle is like, you got to look to see it.
So do you think that a person is coming in, pulling up the blinds, and then standing at a strategic position outside because they want to see that?
Sorry, what? Somebody wants to look
in? Do you think somebody's
in?
Strategically doing that? Because you mentioned like, they, you know, They'd have to be specifically
looking. I think that somebody from the building across from us is coming into the building and lifting the blinds and going...
Have you thought about it?
I haven't thought about
that. You know what I think? I think you're thinking about it too much.
I would second that.
Yeah. We're going to have to throw... We have a new segment here. Throw to our anchor. Let's see what she has to say.
Final goodbyes to this fallen Louisville police officer, D.D. Mega Doodoo.
Christ. That was a...
D.D. Mega Doodoo.
Oh, how'd you fuck that up? All right. Breaking news. We got breaking news. There is a young man... speaking of housing costs, there is one young man who is... Dude, this is a hack. This
3D
is a
printing houses.
This is a fucking hack. It is wild. Check out this story.
It's a stunning example of just how unaffordable Vancouver is.
Yeah,
become.
I saw this actually.
A university student is commuting to his classes from Calgary. As Abigail Turner reports, the flights make financial sense in the region.
So this guy lives in Calgary. For American listeners, that's in the province of Alberta.
Commuting to class looks different for Tim Chen.
And he flies to class from Calgary to Vancouver.
I'm sorry, but I just can't imagine that this is financially more feasible.
Watch, they break it down right here. So 687 kilometers is how far he lives.
I don't feel that is, like, you know, viable.
He pays roughly $150 per round-trip flight twice a week, about $1,200 per month total. That's half the average rent for a one-bedroom.
Where does he stay in Vancouver?
Yeah.
Why don't we just... Why don't I just stay at Calgary and then just fly here? Like, you know,
one also,
and then there's rent in Calgary.
And it doesn't factor in the cost of, like, eating in the airport, the cost of driving to the airport. I think that's bad math.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, you're assuming a lot. Maybe he has a friend in Vancouver, right? Not only are they providing him with a bed to sleep in, but also providing him with
this person,
an orifice
this person,
to explore.
This person has failed to do one thing and failed to know one thing. This person does not know that time is money. This person has never heard that sentence.
I don't know. I looked at that and I thought, all right, well,
I think it highlights
he's coming out on the other end with more money than he would be if he was living in Vancouver.
According to that, I highly doubt it. But also, I think it does highlight the fact, like, the, you know, this entire conversation about the cost of living.
Yeah.
I'd Vancouver also be surprised.
Nuts.
Vancouver is, but I'm sure it's not, like, Calgary's not a, you know, much better situation. If you look at most major cities in Canada, I assume all of them are dealing with the same problem with the cost of living.
I don't think rent in Vancouver is that much different from Halifax. Like, housing prices are different, but I don't know how different rent is.
One thing I do know, though, is that he might not be considering the risks associated with flying to class 8 times a week.
Yeah, because we haven't figured out how to keep those things in the air quite yet.
Enough. Well, it's not even just...
I have had it with these motherfucking snakes.
Yeah, right.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Right? Like, I mean...
You never know.
I'm about to open some fucking windows.
I mean, you get Samuel L. Jackson on your plane, he's going to open the fucking windows. Right?
Yeah.
If there's snakes on it. And so, like, that is a risk, because when the windows of a plane are open while you are at 40,000 feet, well, I mean, I don't know. I've watched enough movies to know that you just get sucked out the window.
Yeah. Well, Boeing's taking a beating right now for just that.
Moving right along. Are you guys familiar with loneliness?
Familiar, yes.
Yes.
It's apparently an epidemic. Even in Japan, they have a loneliness minister of loneliness.
Yeah. Apparently there's a few countries that have implemented this.
Yeah, which is cool. I want to talk about a recent study out of Oxford University that's kind of a fucking win for us boys, I got to say. But before we do, just some tips on living alone. So we're going to throw to another correspondent here.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sebrul with a special report on living on your lonesome. You live alone like I do? Well, guess what? There's stuff you can do to make it not be so awful.
Right. Thank you, Steve. So what we will come into some tips on how to make living alone not so awful. But before we do, let's get into this Oxford University study, which is stating that nights for the boys are for your health.
I saw this.
Nights for the boys.
The study delves into a fascinating exploration of male social dynamics and its impact on health, drawing from a recent research spearheaded by Robin Dunbar, a distinguished figure in the field of psychology at Oxford University. The study suggests a compelling proposition. Men require a minimum of two dedicated, they say meetups, but boys' nights per week, for the boys only, no girls allowed, with their friends, who are boys, to foster not just camaraderie, but also tangible health benefits. Robin Dunbar, infamous for the Dunbar number and his work on friendships.
Is that the Dunbar number, like the amount of like close relationships that you can, you have a capacity?
200.
For? Yeah, I believe it is. Yes.
That's the number, 200.
Yeah. So same dude. He's the director of Oxford University's Social and Evolutionary Neuroscience Research Group.
Self-proclaimed bro himself.
He is a very, loves a good Bud Light. He is very specific with his prescription. Men must physically meet with four friends two times a week in order to reap the benefits of male friendship. Those benefits, in addition to general health, include faster recovery times when faced with illnesses and even higher levels of generosity. Now, who doesn't love getting together with friends and just having a fucking
beer? That's like, you know,
hell yeah.
A beer and maybe a bonfire, right? Maybe like a couple of one bonfire in the house.
Oh. This is all AI generated. The other thing that Dunbar said is, though, although it's not a requirement...
holy fuck, this party's fucking getting lit.
Holy shit.
For everybody who's just listening, which is everybody because this episode's not on YouTube, that was an AI beer commercial that is...
unsettling.
A fucking nightmare. It is a nightmare. I love it.
The interesting thing that Dunbar also said was that although it's not a necessity, it's highly recommended that all the boys should at one point during the night take off all their clothes.
Hey, camaraderie.
Yeah. And they did. He did also say that skin to skin holding of each other does foster stronger connections.
Brian, I wish I had the skin on skin clip heat up here
from the guy.
From the bald guy
no, in Vancouver. No, the guy who drinks all the pee.
No. So we'll get into more of the in depth here, but I do want to throw back, because I know that some people don't have friends to meet up with once a week. So if that is the case and you are all by your lonesome and you want to make it less awful, here's one tip from our correspondent, Mr. Brewer.
Tip number one, spend a lot of your time on Sunday making sandwiches for the rest of the week. Then you're prepared, you turkey.
Wow. All right, there we go. That's tip number one.
That actually is a very,
so
very
keep that
tip
in your back pocket if you don't have friends to take your clothes off with and hang out with. A U.S. professor specializing in studying the psychology of boys and men, masculinity and manhood, is actually going to make the case for creating men's centers on campuses during an address in Toronto.
Oh, he's a men's rights activist.
Central to Dunbar's findings is the notion that the quality of male friendships is intrinsically linked to physical interaction. In an era dominated by digital connectivity, where virtual friendships flourish on social media platforms, and you could even say VR or video games, the study underscores an irreplaceable value of face-to-face, skin-to-skin encounters. Dunbar goes so far as to recommend guys do stuff, in quotes.
Right.
Anything at all.
It says read docking.
rolling boulders down hills, that sort of thing.
Do stuff while they socialize. So in addition to drinking beer and laughing together.
Wait, does it actually say that?
Yes. Men should try to choose to play a number of team sports, like Greco-Roman wrestling, oiled Greco-Roman wrestling.
Lots of oil.
Quote, bonds can be formed through a range of activities, from team sports to male banter, or simply having a pint with your pals on a Friday night without your clothes on, which is, you know, like we actually have a pretty consistent standing boys night once a week here at the office, which has been, I mean, it's like, it's awesome. It's like one of the huge things that I always look forward to. Totally. But again, if you don't have that, you don't have an office where you can bring your friends to sit down, watch grown men on a TV get really sweaty, beat the living fuck out of each other, and like roll around on the ground. Mm-hmm. And you know, while you were doing that, take off your clothes and oil up and wrestle yourselves. You could do this. This is tip number two.
Second tip is go to bed early, you doofus.
That's a good one. Mm-hmm.
When you're sleeping, there's no lonely times.
No lonely times dreams. When you're sleeping.
That's right.
Just dreams. Thank you, Steve.
Especially if you're dreaming of your friends without their clothes on, all oiled up.
Times while you're sleeping.
Interestingly, Dunbar delineates a specific prescription for nurturing these friendships, a group of five, including oneself, convening twice weekly. This recommendation is grounded not just in anecdotal observations, but also in rigorous scientific analysis, drawing from Dunbar's extensive research on the dynamics of human relationships. He posits that this small intimate circle allows for deeper connections, fostering an environment where laughter flows freely and endorphins, the body's natural feel-good chemicals, are released in abundance, therefore bolstering overall health.
Wow.
And we all know that one of the biggest ways to release a massive boost of endorphins like dopamine is to ejaculate. And there's, mm-hmm. there's some sort of modalities of looking at this of like, what's it called? It's like
man cream swapping.
Yeah. Or well, no, there was the guy that drinks the pee. He's big on it.
He's really big on it.
Oh, perennial sunning.
No,
it's in like, the same neighborhood.
It's kind of like it's like I don't know. It's like yoni tugging, but it's not yoni because yoni's not for the boys.
Yeah.
Moreover, the study sheds light on the potential pitfalls of relying solely on digital interactions. Despite the convenience and prevalence of online communication channels, the benefits derived from virtual friendships pale in comparison to those garnered from face-to-face interactions.
No doubt.
Dunbar's research reveals a stark reality. A significant portion of men struggle to prioritize physical meetups amidst their busy schedules, with one in three unable to carve out time for evening, weekly gatherings.
I mean, honestly, I know we have our one night that we are usually together on the weekends,
but we don't have two.
We don't have two, but we are with a kid and with a second on the way, and you know, Kyla's been struggling with some family stuff with her mom in the hospital, and like my schedule has just been like anything after 4 p.m. is like almost impossible. Like I very rarely even find time to be like working out in the last like couple months,
which is why we've created the greatest hack of all.
Work with your friends.
Yeah, or like work with your friends.
Throughout a day, we probably gather about 20, 30, 40 minutes of like total guy night time.
Like micro hangs.
Yeah, microdosing.
You know? Hey, look at check out this Instagram reel. Do you guys all see this? And then we gather around and we make jokes. And then like, we also do it for our work.
Hey, look over here. Just check out my nipples.
Yeah. And like, hey, here, chug this beer.
Yeah.
Before the client call.
Yeah. If you got this
new game on GameCube.
Yeah. If you don't have beer or nipples, here's tip number three.
You can make up your own puzzles.
Yep.
Oh, fuck, yeah.
You can make up your own puzzles? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great suggestion.
It's not any more complicated than that.
It's pretty simple.
And puzzles are easy to make up.
I love puzzles. I love making them up, too.
Take a picture that you like from your stuff and cut it into pieces. Then you won't know how the heck to put it back together.
Yeah,
and it's a homemade puzzle of yours.
Right. Totally.
Right. Thank you, Steve.
Man.
So I do want to say, okay, Steve. Fucking
of the guy, the door ajar sound in the background.
So notably, I do find this quite funny, and it maybe a little bit sus, but notably, the research was commissioned by Guinness.
That is a little sus.
Let's fucking go.
It was
commissioned by Guinness, the renowned purveyor of fine beverages, adding an intriguing dimension to the findings. While some may view this association skeptically, it's essential to recognize the underlying message, which is true. The act of sharing a drink with friends transcends mere indulgence. It serves as a catalyst for strengthening bonds and enriching lives. And drinks also include coffee and tea and juice.
And this is none of this is tainted.
It was interesting how it said beer in the study. I feel like
that's the Guinness part.
I think that's the Guinness influence.
Guinness had a stipulation in the contract to receive funding for this that was like, you must mention beer.
Yeah, one Guinness a day keeps the Dr. Steve Brewer away, and that is...
for your health!
All right, well, I hope you enjoyed that, and thanks for tuning in. Thanks for being here and supporting us. Again, for the new listeners, this is like a new format for us, and we're having a lot of fun with it. And I hope that you guys that are tuning in, who've been with us from the start, are enjoying the fact that we have found a way to take all of the aspects of the three episodes a week that we used to be putting out and just kind of cramming them all into one super epic episode every single week. So thank you for your support. If you want to continue to support the podcast in other ways, you can leave a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can subscribe to the podcast on YouTube. Again, coming up in the next couple of weeks, we're going to be getting into the process of uploading every single episode to YouTube. We're really excited about it. So you can do that. And of course, come on over to the Discord. It's a fucking boys' night and a half, and there's lots of people that aren't boys there. People that aren't girls, people that aren't boys.
You can be whatever you want.
You can be whatever. Yeah. And you could upload your fucking avatar there, and you could be
a cat.
Yes. And so come on over to the Discord, and right, lots of fun chats happening over there. And we love everybody in our Discord, and we love everybody, all of our patrons even more. So come on over and give a hang.
And if you want to be a guest on the show, thanks for not stealing that from me this week. You can go to sickboypodcast.com and fill out the form.
And thanks to the folks who make these shows happen. A huge thank you to Donovan Morgan for the sound design, to Rich O'Cohen for the theme music, to Jeff Lonis, our manager, and to Annika, our production assistant. We love all of you guys.
That is it for this week.
I'm Brian.
I'm Taylor.
And I'm Jeremy, and this is Sick Boy.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.